Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Motorsport Commentary, behind the scenes for the June 2017 edition of Motorsport Magazine. Joining me at Foster today is Art Editor Damon Cogman, Features Editor Simon Aaron, Deputy Editor Joe Dunn, and Editor Nick Trott. We're also excited to announce a new face, photographer Lyndon McNeil, who has recently joined the Motorsport editorial team. Lyndon is an award-winning photographer who has been shooting cars on the road and track for over 15 years. Apparently, photography has been a passion since childhood, and he also has an excellent beard. So, welcome, Lyndon.
Hello, thank you.
So another full house today, which is extremely exciting. So we're going to go through the June edition of the magazine and give you a little bit of behind-the-scenes information on how it came together and some of those sort of secrets to how it's done. You'll all be publishing your own magazine soon, so we'll have to stop this. Let's start with the cover. It's a lovely photo of Senna. It's with the sort of headline, Lap of the Gods. Now, this is it's the truth behind racing's greatest laps. Nick, I'm going to come to you first. Where did this idea come from? Because it's not left field, but it's done in a slightly different way.
Yeah, it's kind of a conceptual cover. It came, as many of the great ideas do in the office, just from a general conversation. And the conversation was, I think, inspired by Joe. Joe's looking at me blankly now. Take credit, Joe. It's okay.
I remember this very well.
Yeah. We had one of those grabbed conversations. Joe was reading a book about sports psychology. I mentioned that I was fascinated in this kind of out-of-body phenomenon that Senna talked about, and a few other drivers talked about. Damon Hill talked about it in his book. And I think that kind of planted a seed about this concept of how this phenomenon helps or maybe hinders the greatest laps. Then we had a features meeting and we started to discuss some of our own favourite greatest laps. And we distilled it and we picked a few laps that we thought that maybe the readers weren't fully aware of. And we refined it a little bit more. And it kind of came together. And then it became clear that we could use it as a cover line, certainly with a suitable image. The image was hugely important. But what I really enjoyed about this process, and you know, this being a behind-the-scenes podcast, what I really enjoyed was the discussions that we had as a team, and particularly as we were trying to get a short list from a very, very, very long list. And there was a clear thing that emerged, which was there was a sequence of great laps, or there was a single lap. And Joe was very, very keen that we had a single lap. There was a single defining lap, not a sequence of laps, because we could have put in, you know, the 12 laps of Schumacher in fifth gear or something like that. But we wanted one lap. And before you know it, it was there. But I think, Joe, take it up, because I'm rambling a little bit.
Well, no, I was going to agree, really. And I think that sometimes, I mean, you can tell when an idea has got legs, and certainly in the office, when something, you know, has got the potential to be a cover story, dependent on the amount of discussion it sparks when we first talk about it. And this one in particular, as you can imagine, the whole office had their own favourite laps there. You know, what constituted a great lap? You know, was it just the time? Was it the fact that, you know, it was qualifying lap? Could you put that in the same category as a race lap? Was the context of, you know, how important the race, how much pressure was on the driver, should that be taken into account? There were loads of other kind of sort of thoughts that everyone sort of threw in, and obviously everyone came up with a list. So it was the more the discussion went on, the more we kind of thought, yeah, we can spin this out and make this a really, really comprehensive look at what makes a great lap.
And I think the discussion is going to go on for some time as well, because we've already had one lettering pointing out that we missed Jochen Rindt's last lap at Monaco in 1970, and surely that should have been in there, and I'm sure there'll be plenty of other discussions along that, of that sort.
I mean, we were careful to say these weren't the greatest laps.
We're kind of owning ourselves for an absolute shoeing, aren't we? If that's the first lecture, I think there'll be a few more.
I mean, we're not necessarily a magazine that does the list format, but I think that there's an opportunity maybe from this that we do, you know, this does spark a debate about the greatest laps, and then maybe over time, if we get some good feedback, and please, you know, if you're listening to this, please respond via our social media or online, motorsportmagazine.com. Is that a good plug, Ed?
Yeah, thank you very much.
That one? No worries at all. Yeah, please respond and let us know, because maybe over time we can compile a list. You know, maybe our readers can decide what were the greatest laps. So, but yeah, it's great that this has already inspired conversation. We've been on sale for three days.
I think we've been on for, yeah, we had been on sale for literally half a day when the first email came in saying, what about Rinter? And it's a good call, because I mean, that, you know, that was
very good.
Did
call.
You
put forward some laps at Lyddon Hill or Alton Park?
I might have done. Can't remember, but it's conceivable.
Yeah. Right. Joe, just before we go on to the image choice on the cover, you were put in charge of actually doing a bit of scientific research and trying to find out what this out-of-body experience was and whether it actually contributed to a fast lap time or not. How on earth do you... how do you begin trying to find something like that out?
One of the things we wanted to nail down in this was to kind of make the story or make the whole feature a little bit more than just our choice of great laps. We wanted to sort of just drill down a little bit more and give the piece a bit of scientific foundation, really. And this idea of an out-of-body experience has been knocking around for a while. Damon Hill, as Nick was saying earlier, Damon Hill wrote about it in his book. Ayrton Senna famously talked about it, or talked about being beyond his own driving, beyond his own consciousness. And I spoke to several drivers who said that this was a well-recognised phenomenon. So, as well as Damon, David Brabham as well was very eloquent about it. We spoke with sports psychologists who recognised the phenomenon, and neurologists who sort of study the brain, and who were very kind of open to the idea that something does happen to racing drivers in particular when they go right to the edge of their ability and at very high speeds, which can improve their driving. So hopefully the feature sort of explains why that happens and what the effect is.
It's not something that's unique to the top level of the sport either. I remember having a conversation with Gilles de Ferran many moons ago, and although Gilles later went on to win Champ Car titles Indy 500, he had a similar experience very early in his career when he was racing Formula Chevrolet in Brazil, and he described having, it felt like he was above the track watching himself from on high and didn't feel connected to what was actually going on at all. And also our own Grand Prix editor Mark Hughes had something similar. He went from the back of the grid in a TVR Tuscan up to about third at Snetterton, and he experienced exactly the same thing and can talk about it very eloquently. So it's something which is, you know, you don't have to be competing at the very top level of the sport to experience this sensation, apparently.
I've never experienced it in the MGB.
There's always time.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I suppose what's interesting as well is that in the kind of hairy-chested world of racing driving, this sort of kind of, you know, what could be dismissed as mumbo-jumbo, kind of as a mysticism, really, is actually taken seriously and, you know, it's accepted and is an accepted phenomenon.
Right, Lyndon, I'm going to come to you to talk about the cover shot. It's quite a general topic, this.
Yes.
How do you even begin to sort of come up with possible images? Because even just from the laps that are discussed in the magazine, there's probably 10, 20 different subjects we could have chosen. So just talk us through the process a bit.
We chose, obviously, Formula One because it is the pinnacle, but it's also showing where you can see the driver at his most in control of the car. I know we talk about Beloff in his Porsche, but with a Group C, you can't see the movement or the undulation that the driver's going through. So with this, we chose Senna in Monaco purely because of having him in the magazine with one of his greatest laps. And this is coming through the chicane at the swimming pool, where he is completely on the limit, as you can see through his eyes, wheels in the air, and it's just, from my point of view, a really striking image. So you can see that he is fully committed.
Yeah.
Do you ever have an out-of-body experience when you're choosing photographs?
No, I can't say I have. No. Sore eyes.
There's still time, apparently. just briefly, Damon, could you just talk about Senna covers, Clark covers, Moss covers. There's a sort of thing, I think, also with music magazines, you know, putting Beatles on the cover. there's an uplift in sales, aren't there? It's, yeah, you know, it's good to get one of the big names on there, but it's true, isn't it?
There is there's always a slight shift in sales because everybody still loves Senna. Senna still has that sort of mystique about him. He's still got that kind of X factor, even all these years later. Senna at Monaco is another thing again, of course. But the idea or the kind of the modern conception of what makes a striking cover and what makes a successful cover is that you use certain things. So women's magazines use Victoria Beckham, as you mentioned, music magazines use certain bands that have kind of stood the test of time, hence Rolling Stone still turning up on covers all the here, there and everywhere. So the hope is that we get a few more sales due to the fact we've got a yellow helmeted Senna on the cover in a Marlboro McLaren. It's an incredible sort of trifecta, isn't it? Senna, Monaco, McLaren, Marlboro, all the rest of them.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to move on because we basically haven't even got past the cover yet, and we've been talking for 15 minutes or so. Nick, I'm going to come to you about the new regular rally page that we have on page 26, which is a new addition to the magazine. World Rally Championship is obviously very exciting at the moment. We've got Brits in there doing well. Ogier's going to M Sports. It's an exciting time for World Rally Championship. Yeah. Is that why we're now dipping back into it? Because there's been a bit of a gap, hasn't there?
Yeah. I think you've summed it up perfectly, to be honest. You know, we obviously try to encompass every key motorsport series and championship around the world. We have limited space, so it's not easy to squeeze everything in, certainly not to the length and depth that we'd like. So but this we had to do. It is an important year for the World Rally Championship. It's got the soap opera element that we all enjoy, I think, in all key motorsports. The approach that we're taking is similar to the way we report on some of the other key motorsport series. We can never guarantee that we'll be absolutely topical due to print schedules. So we've asked our writer, who's at every round of the World Rally Championship, to just tell us the stories behind the stories. And I think he did a good job in putting the success and maybe some of the dilemmas that Sebastian Ogier is experiencing at the moment, because he was effectively without a drive at the end of last year, and his life had changed. He's got a young son, and I won't give away the story, but I do think I've learned something in here that I hadn't read and understood in any other media source. So I'm pleased with it, and it is a regular. We'll be continuing this until the end of the season and carry on into next year.
So what might not be a regular is Fernando Alonso doing the Indy 500 this year. Mark Hughes talks about it in his column on page 31. It's worth remembering that we did actually break this story in the July 2016 edition of the magazine almost 12 months ago. So pat on the back for us there. What are everyone's thoughts on Alonso doing Indy rather than Monaco? Simon, I'll come to you.
I just think it's absolutely fabulous. Formula One has become so homogenised insofar as the calendar follows. I mean, the odd new race comes here and there, but it follows a pretty similar pattern most years. Teams don't, we don't get extra oddball extra entries at local drives at their home Grand Prix and stuff. Everything's very, very set in stone. And to actually get something which is, it isn't left field because it's happened in the past, obviously Jim Clark in 1965 most famously, but for it to happen in the modern age when drivers are kind of pigeonholed, he's a Formula One driver, he doesn't do anything else. He's a touring car driver, he doesn't do anything else. To actually have something like that, I mean, I know Nico Hülkenberg did Le Mans a couple of years ago and won in 2015, but this, you know, a contemporary F1 driver doing the Indy 500, it shouldn't be an eye-opening story, but just because the way the sport has evolved, it is, and, you know, more power to his elbow.
Yeah. Nick?
Yeah, it's off the scale, absolutely extraordinary, brilliant. For us, personally, as press, amazing. Absolutely amazing, and I really hope that it means other drivers are looking at what to do now. Chuffed to bits, even though I wasn't with motorsport then, that we broke the story. I think that was really important. And it'd be great to hear from our listeners, actually, in terms of who they would like to see kind of cross over some disciplines, because, you know, we've seen it a little bit. We've seen Loeb in rallycross and touring cars
and testing F1 cars
and testing it and bloody quick as well. And podium at Le Mans, you know. So let's hear from, you know, our listeners. Personally, everyone's talking about the Triple Crown. I'm a huge Montoya fan. I'd like to see Montoya do Le Mans and go for a win. I was with him in Bahrain a couple of years ago when he tested the Porsche, and within three laps he was half a second off of, you know, works driver pace. He was amazing. Once they got him in the car, you know, he was why are you laughing
why are you looking at me at this point?
That was a seat issue.
I was busy that day.
So yeah, well, great, brilliant, absolutely brilliant, and let's see what happens next. And of course, you know, let's get Rossi at Le Mans, yeah, as well.
Absolutely,
he wants to do it. Rossi, Alonso, Montoya, Le Mans.
Dream team.
In a dream team. In a Porsche, maybe. If we plant these seeds in, people listen. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Hello, hello out there.
But it was quite interesting yesterday afternoon when the Indianapolis Motor Speedway did a video cast from the test session. And I looked around the office in the afternoon. It's just one orange car going around on its own. And pretty much everyone in the office is watching it, keeping an eye on it.
Really? I didn't know.
We were definitely working.
Oh, dear. I was out yesterday window. Afternoon.
There was a
quick boss is coming. Click.
Should we move on? So Mark also has a piece on Valtteri Bottas, which was written after the Bahrain Grand Prix, before his Russian Grand Prix victory. But as typically with Mark, it's a very measured piece. It's weirdly, it hasn't dated despite the fact that he's since got a win. I'm going to fast forward on to Dickie Meaden on page 40, who's discussing historic racing. He's basically posing the question, is the history the thing that we like, or is it the racing? And should some of the cars that are being raced be raced, or should they be kept as they were in period? Simon, I'm actually going to come back to you firstly on this one. Because
I'm old.
Well, no, I wasn't going to say that. Whatever you
distinguished.
Say.
I think the implication was clear.
Experienced, but also that you spend 99% of your time sat or stood beside a racetrack watching these cars go around. What are your thoughts on it?
The more the merrier. The body language of...
Is that race meetings for you, or do you mean cars?
Both. The body language of the older cars, even with more modern tyres, I mean, you know, they still have suspension that moves. They're still exciting to watch. Even one of them going around on its own, it'll be slow. You know, it's not glued to the road, so they are naturally quite engaging to watch. And when there's a field of 30 or 40 of them, marvellous. And we've seen increasingly, I've mentioned it in almost every podcast we've ever done. Historic Formula Ford, for example.
I thought he was going to say Alton Park then.
No, though I mentioned that as well. Yeah. Historic Formula Ford, for example, you've got a clutch of 8 to 10 really quick young kids racing these old cars with no aero influence, and they just run around. They hunt in a pack, and they're fantastic to watch. And Ditto, you go to Goodwood, where you've got top caliber drivers in these nice old cars that slide around, and the ferocity of the competition is immense. And it's not just at Goodwood; it's at most historic meetings. It's just fabulous.
Lyndon, do you find it easier to photograph historic cars in terms of getting a dramatic?
Because again, more slowly.
Dramatically, yes, because you've got the pitch and the roll, and there is generally a lot more going on. Modern, I won't say Formula or saloons, but you don't get the aggressiveness in the body language of the cars when, you know, as they're fighting for position. When you're shooting a modern car, it's just very processional in a way. I know touring cars, there's a bit of argy-bargy, but otherwise it's very, once you're in the lead or in fifth, sixth, that's generally where you stay. But with historics, you just see everybody's battling for position from first down to last, and it's great to watch and shoot, and you're generally getting cars full opposite lock through virtually every corner, and that's what we're looking for, that little bit of drama.
I was going to say, because if you get a modern touring car, the Thruxton Chicane, for example, it'll be airborne, it'll have two wheels, but it's still
stayed.
It's quite flat, whereas if it's a Hillman Imp, you know, one of the wheels will be somewhere near the top of the wheel arch, and the other one will, you know, be.
But the body language of the car will be very aggressive, or on an MGB, in fact.
Yeah, from Formula One, from Alonso doing the Indy 500 to Helmut Nims. We don't say we don't cover everything in this talk show podcast.
I'm going to read a small sentence from Dickie's column, because he does a really good job of describing the aesthetic of a historic racing car. And discusses the difference between those that have been, restored almost beyond their original condition and those that have been left with all the battle scars. So there's a really, really lovely sentence here. To me, patina is magical. Like wrinkles or scars, a racing car with a few stone chips and scuffs or scratches and stains shows signs of a life lived to the full. Yet look around any historic paddock, and even those more superficial cosmetic signs of race-to-race aging are unusual. I'm not expecting owners to field cars that look like a Penske, Donahue's war-torn Ferrari 512S or a Lola T70 at the end of the Daytona 24 Hours. Though on reflection, that would be magnificent. But a bit of patination wouldn't go amiss.
I think it's quite right. And I think he expresses the kind of paradox, I suppose, of historic racing versus original cars brilliantly. And I don't know what sparked the piece, but I suspect it might have been last month's cover story on the RS500, which he drove, and talking to him afterwards, Dickie was just talking, waxing lyrical about the smell of sweat that he had when he sat in the drive, because this was a completely original car, wasn't it? It hadn't been tampered with at all. It was period. And Dickie actually loved it, and just said there was something about being in the driver's seat, knowing that nothing had changed in the intervening 30 years since it was raced in competition, that was magical.
I think he would have liked the tyres to have been a little bit
maybe the tyres
newer, a bit less
with 500 horsepower. Yes. But you're absolutely right, Joe. I think that's what inspired it. Yeah, good piece.
Moving on to page 43, we've got Richard Williams, who's talking about Formula One circuits and the problems with them, and he's discussing the fact that, you know, somewhere like Bahrain, I think he says even Da Vinci couldn't have created something exciting on a flat sort of desert land. But we've got Richard Williams, then we've got Matt Oxley on page 45. I'm not going to go into Formula One circuits, because with the people around this table, we will not stop talking about the problems with them for many hours. Matt Oxley on page 45, talking about aerodynamics in MotoGP, which have come in sort of first with Ducati. Lots of complaints, but you know they might be here to stay. It's also worth mentioning, actually, that we on the website, you can ask Matt at most MotoGP rounds this year, you can ask him any question you like. And if he doesn't, well, within reason, if he doesn't know, he will then go off and discuss things with engineers, riders, whoever it is in the paddock, and he will answer your question as soon as he can. So it's worth doing and quite fun. On to page 46, Hall of Fame. We are announcing the top three in each category. I'm not going to go through them all, because you'll need to buy the magazine to know who the top three are. There's some amazing names in there. If only we could induct more than we're allowed to, because there's certainly more than deserving ones of them. And we've also actually got a number of guests that have been announced. We've got Ari Vatanen, Brian Redman, Freddie Spencer, John Watson, Joe Ramirez, David Richards, Jackie Oliver, Murray Walker, Paul Hollywood, not such a famous racing driver, but a chef, Freddie Hunt, and James Toseland. So there's loads of guests coming already. There'll be more announced soon, and you can still buy tickets. You can do that up until May the 31st, midnight on Wednesday, May 31st. To book them, just go to the motorsportmagazine.com/Hall of Fame. Andrew Frankel, page 50, he's talking about two sort of recreations, I guess they are. One is Jaguar doing new Series 1 E-types, and then another one is called the Mini Remastered by David Brown. Not that David Brown, but a David Brown. What are everyone's thoughts on this? Because they come in at a mere snip of £285,000 and then £70,000. Yeah, to the table.
There's a market for them. You know, I mean, it's we get very emotional about the concept of a restoration, resto mod, or however you want to phrase it. But the manufacturers wouldn't be doing it unless there was a market for it. I've followed this for years. I'm fascinated by the phenomenon of a resto mod, and I think you can, if you wind it back, you can look at what Singer did with Porsches, and they created a whole new market, a whole new audience for this type of car, in the same way that Bugatti did with the Veyron. And of course, everyone's following, and the fact that car manufacturers are doing it, as well, Aston Martin, are doing it. I personally think is great. If people want these cars, they're
brilliant. I think it's great to not get hooked up on the price too much, because the people that want these are going to pay for them, whatever.
They're generally all sold before they even announce them.
That's right. Yeah. And actually, £70,000 for a Mini, although is a huge sum of money. If you look at how much a Mini Cooper is worth on the second-hand market in the auction world, it's not that dissimilar, and similarly, a brand new E-Type, obviously at the price that it is, or a beautifully restored Series One, is not that far away from what these things are being offered for. So they're not in. Obviously, they're expensive. They're hugely expensive.
So have you bought one?
not quite. But that Mini is pretty lovely, though. Oh my God, that's so lovely.
From a person, the David Brown. Speedback, I think, was a rather challenging machine in terms of the way it looked and creates a lot of controversy. But I think he's absolutely nailed it with the Mini. You know,
the mixture of new and old is just beautifully done. Yeah. The fact that he's taken modern techniques and manufacturing means it won't creak. It won't sort of all the things.
You won't have transmission whine.
No,
subframe won't fall out.
The A-frame won't rust. It's all good.
I have a request for our listeners to propose and get in touch the cars that they would like to see either resto modded or reimagined, because there is another step that manufacturers haven't yet been brave enough to take, and that is the Singer approach. So the E-Type that we see here is an E-Type, whichever way, it's a brand new E-Type. But what about an E-Type with modern mechanicals, which is kind of what Singer does with the Porsches? They take an old 964 and they put more modern mechanicals in it. And I would love to see a car manufacturer take the kind of aesthetic of an older car but put modern mechanicals in it. And I'd love to hear someone suggest it. I mean, personally, things like a 635 BMW, or like with a modern kit in it, would be off the scale.
Well, in the hot rod world, there's the V10 BMW engine is used massively, because it's obviously it's just cheap sort of and it's still dropped into old 3 series and 5 series, but to a manufacturer approved version of that, oh my God, can you imagine? That would be so amazing.
You two would be bankrupt.
Yeah. Well, even more bankrupt. Yeah. I did happen to ask a manufacturer of modern British supercars the other day whether they would indulge themselves in something like this, and it was a very, very firm no. Very firm no.
It's not just the big manufacturers. I noticed that Lister just released a new road car,
which
looks absolutely stunning. So it's small brands as well, which have been bought and are now producing road cars as well.
I think the fact that manufacturers are being this brave is to be celebrated as well. The fact that they're making these steps and sort of putting these things out there is fantastic. You know, giving people the choice is amazing, albeit expensive, but equally, the fact they're doing it is great.
Series One in Esprit. On a modern Exige platform with a V6. This is going to go on forever.
Yeah, okay, guys, stop us. I'm looking at we should, let's press on to the features, because we've talked about the greatest laps. We did that at the start. We've next got a feature on page 96 called Chasing Beloff, where Dickie Meaden tries to break Beloff's ring record in Toyota's LMP1 machine. It's not quite what it says on the tin, though, is it, Joe?
Well, it is in a way.
a newspaper man.
we've enlisted the help of Toyota, who have very kindly lent us their simulator and reprogrammed it with the original Nordschleife route, which is the one that Dickie takes on, and he. Obviously, it should be a done deal. I mean, this is a car with 30 years of technical advancement compared to Beloff's vehicle, and he should, even given Beloff's talent behind the wheel, and Dickie's a very good driver, he should be able to break this record. But
and he won't get hurt if he
and there's no fear if he gets it wrong, so he can push the limit. But the, I mean, I won't ruin the story as to whether he manages it or not. But the way Dickie takes us through the obviously the history of that particular record, and how he attempts to beat it is absolutely fascinating, and gives a brilliant insight as well into what modern endurance racers and how they train and what they go through.
Yeah,
I was just going to say. I mean, this is no, you know, this isn't a PlayStation type simulator. This isn't a Forza game. This is the simulator that Toyota use pretty much all the time to work out strategy, to figure out dynamics. This is the proper sim. You know, the mind boggles in terms of how much this thing costs. So this is the closest we can get to lapping a modern, you know, lapping Launch Life in a modern endurance car. Although we did ask, I'd say I did ask. I knew what the answer was going to be. But you know, could we? Okay, so let's try it on the sim. But Toyota, I have to say, are absolutely brilliant. You know, manufacturers tend not to let people go into their sims. But wow, what a story! And I kind of like the fact that the sim was also imperfect as well. Again, I won't give too much away, but the sim, I love the fact that the most modern technology and the biggest brains created this sim, but the sim had trouble getting its head around Belos ring lap.
it was like computer says no at some point, wasn't it? It was brilliant, absolutely. But the other thing, I mean, talking about the sim, I mean, the level of detail that the sim reproduces, I mean, it reproduces the camber of the road as you go around the track. It reproduces the bumps that you get in the road. I mean, it is so lifelike. It's quite astounding.
We then fast forward on to page 102. We've got Mark Hughes talking about Ferrari's sort of re-emergence. It's a fascinating piece sort of about the philosophy behind the success they've had. And he talks about high potential people and high performers, which in its sort of most basic form refers to giving people opportunities to take on more senior roles rather than going out of house and hiring big names. But it's a very interesting look at kind of explaining why Ferrari has managed to turn things around between the end of last year and this year. Page 106, this feature called Square Root. Lyndon, I'm going to come straight to you. It's the story of a racing Volvo 242. Jack Phillips is the guy who wrote our online content assistant, who loves Volvos and has a 240 himself. So I think it was quite difficult for him to leave. But it wasn't an easy day, was it? Because the photos
never. You're always challenged on a shoot when you never know where you're going to be or what you can do with a car, especially if it's not a track test. We were given a location which was the restorer's home address, I believe, and a quick Google images to try and find where you're going to be. I won't say we struggled, because you make the most of what you're given on the day, and I hope, you know, the pictures kind of do it justice, shall we say. So it was a big, heavy car that didn't move, but we managed to move it, get it outside. The sun shone on us, and we were lucky enough to shoot it and make it look beautiful.
Invariably, though, these magazine shoots, they never quite go according to plan, do they? They're never easy.
There's never a plan.
How are you?
No, you never know. Track tests, you never know if the car's going to break down or what the weather's going to be like on the day. You can't guarantee everything, so you have a small plan in mind, and if you can tick all those boxes and more, then you're always happy.
Sorry, Damon, I thought you were going to
jump in there. Obviously with this is an odd choice of subject matter, but it just illustrates the diversity that Motorsport has, and I love the fact that we can have the Ferrari F1 feature, and then the next feature you turn the page and you get a Volvo 242. It's fantastic.
It's not by accident, though, is it?
Oh no, absolutely not. Of course it is. But it's,
no, we have. I mean, since the beginning of the year, we've looked, haven't we? And we've actually, in a way, we've categorised features, and we've and there's one category that's called weird SH something T. Yes. Because there's always a feature that pops up.
This falls just into that one, doesn't it?
I think it does, yeah, a little bit. But we are conscious, especially, you know, Damon and I and Joe, when we're looking at the flat plan, we're conscious of things like the pace of the magazine, and we're conscious that when people are flipping through the mag, they need to be stopped in their tracks. And so we flat plan the issue like that. You know, we plan where the pages are. And Damon's absolutely right. We've gone from a roundup of some of the greatest laps in history to a piece on inside one of the world's most advanced simulators to a piece on modern Ferrari in F1 and then a flying brick. So, and I just, you know, I still feel like a fan of motorsport. I'm a newbie, but I still feel like a fan. And I can see myself going through this issue going, oh, brilliant. what a stopper, you know. So, and have we gone from that to another contrasty piece?
I'm going to come to you now.
Is this because I'm old again?
You've got potential.
I'm not saying anything. But on page 114, a piece called Friends Reunited, unsung 60s sports car racer, Digby Martland, and you went off and you reunited him with a Chevron B6.
Yeah, I mean, the actual idea came from, Kevin Kivlokan, who owns the B6 nowadays, and he called me and said, look, I've got this thing, I've discovered a 6 Digby Martland car. Digby was, as you said, unsung. I mean, I knew the name quite well because I am from the north near Alton Park, and Digby had a lot of success with Chevrons at Alton. I'm not sure I saw
where,
him.
Sorry, where?
Alton Park. Not Loughton Park, Alton Park. I might have seen him race late in the 60s, I don't know. I was too young then to be registering all the names and chassis type numbers and things as I would start doing early in the 70s. But, I mean, he raced from the early 60s, mid-60s, through to 1970, then stopped. A lot of success with Chevrons. Kevin had the car, and we decided to try and track Digby down. We knew he was in Jersey somewhere, and we made various phone calls trying to find him, and weren't having much success. And then Kevin came up with the idea of director inquiries, and Digby having quite a distinctive name. We found there was only one Digby Martland in Jersey, and we actually tracked him down, despite using all our racing contacts between us, in the end, directory inquiries.
And that still exists?
Well, apparently, yeah. It might be called something else nowadays, but that's how we found him. And
you have heard of the internet, haven't you?
That didn't work. That didn't work, I promise you, it didn't work.
That's amazing.
And, yeah, anyway, we found him, got him over to, he was coming over to Silverstone, so we photographed him with the car. And subsequently, I met up with him in London a couple of months later to discuss his career. A lovely gent, and he's got
the one thing comes across in those photos is how delighted he was to kind of be reunited with the car.
When I asked him it was the first time he'd seen that particular car in 50 odd years, and I said, you know, how did it feel seeing it again? And he actually started to falter as he spoke to me because he was, you know, he still has a really strong emotional attachment. Even though he walked away from the sport in 1970, never to race again, you know.
No. I mean, I know Simon sat in front of me, but this is a stunning piece. You know,
well, photos.
Photos are great.
I just actually slipped in 20 quid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 25, Simon. No, really, really. And I guess, I know we're blowing our own trumpet here, but what we do and what Simon does really well is extract these incredible nuggets of information that we've never heard before, and you know, this is our life, and we, you know, we have a lot of knowledge by now. But your comment about or the quote you got about Digby's run at Avis, and the fact that he qualified fourth, the only Chevron wheel set off, and I was swept along in the draft of three Porsche 906s down that long, long straight. So soon ran out of revs. I had to let the top three go, or the rev counter was going to be way off the clock. I mean, I was sat in that car reading that, and I think that's what motorsport, and Simon does it absolutely brilliantly. So great story, and I know some people may turn the page and won't recognise the face, but I really, really, I do ask people to have a good read of this because it's a cracker.
Yeah. Now, it's going much further afield now. It's the long and winding road, page 122. Frankel had been to Bathurst, and he gets all the good jobs, doesn't he, Andrew? Hello, Andrew.
Whiff of jealousy there, yeah. I think. You were too busy with spreadsheets.
This is a fantastic trip, though, isn't it? Because Bathurst, I think, it's the first time Andrew's been, and I was asking the office yesterday if anybody had actually been themselves, but no one has on this team, but it is...
I am working on it.
Yeah, well, you're too busy at Alton Park, so you can't go to Bathurst. But it is a bucket list event and trip, and it's lovely how Andrew talks you through the history of the race and how it was this sort of wild, hairy, kind of dangerous thing to spectate at, but that's been toned down a bit, but it hasn't lost its character. which yeah. I think he gets across very well.
Yeah, again, firstly, really, we were the only UK title to be invited to attend this and spend some time with Bentley. So that was great. That, you know, good for us. Andrew was dead keen to attend, and he writes beautifully, Andrew, and he really manages to weave the history, as you say, the history of the event and the colour, with the kind of the challenge that it serves up to the modern cars, the modern GT3 cars. So he follows a soap opera nicely of what was a very dramatic race. And yeah, really well done. I know Lyndon didn't shoot this one, but
some
great photography though in this
there
case,
is, yeah.
isn't there? I particularly love the shot on 127. It's an angle that you don't see that often, isn't it?
It's yeah, you're not often given access into the cars that easy.
Now it's hopefully everyone around this table knows that it's Father's Day coming up on June 18th. Do we all know that?
Yeah, do now.
Yeah, there we go.
great, I feel something coming on.
Great sons you all are. But it is it's coming out on Sunday, June the 18th. And if you want any kind of present ideas or anything like that, for a discerning motorsport fan, then we do have DVDs, books, luggage, bookazines, loads of stuff on the motorsport shop. So do have a look at that. It's motorsportmagazine.com/shop. You have been warned, don't forget it. Right, we kind of briefly touched on this earlier, Nick. You were talking about the pace of the magazine and things like that. Just tell people how you do that, because there is a board in the office that used to have stupid quotes that the editorial team had said throughout a working day. But there is a way of doing that rather than just having it on the computer, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. Some of it's by instinct and some of it's by design. I think, to be honest, I think Damon's a little bit better at this process than
Mr.
I am.
Mr. Organised over here.
But yeah, you're right. Where have the quotes gone off the wall?
They're behind my desk now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. The
next to the board.
The most important thing is that they still exist. Yeah, pace is hugely important. The board now shows printouts of each page, and we can move them around kind of like a... I don't know, crazy Tetris, and we can see how the pace goes. With Damon, go on. No,
it's just a way to format the mag. Every magazine has an invisible structure to it, when you skim through a magazine, you never really consider that, and rightly so. You should all enjoy it for what it is. But behind the scenes, there is a framework that it all kind of adheres to, and the board on the wall, which we could put a picture on online or something.
We will. We'll put a photo and then give away the next issue while we're at it.
Hang on, rewind.
Well, a sneak preview. Some
sneak
of
preview. Yeah. Yeah, there we go. So yeah, the flat plan and the board illustrates this sort of idea of a magazine in a big flat format that you can sort of move pages around and kind of just be very clear about how the pace we mentioned earlier on about the going from a modern F1 story to a 60s sports car to an 80s touring car. So it's all usually by design. It kind of sometimes there's a happy accident in there, but 9 times out of 10 it's usually designed that way and created that way.
Not blind luck then. Look at that. Team of professionals. To go back to the magazine, we've got Lunch with Paul Stewart on page 134. And those of you who've listened to our podcasts and things will know that we also did a podcast with him that was released very recently. But there's a lot more in the Lunch with than in the podcast. So it's worth reading one and listening to the other. Nick, you're looking at me and keep waving. Are you about to throw your microphone at me, or are you
going to say
something?
Well, do you know what? I mean, I know you're the anchor for this. That's with an A. So you rarely... No, but you rarely get the chance.
How long have you been thinking of that joke?
I was saving it up for weeks. No, it just came into my head, and I was thinking, should I say that? So I'm sorry if I've just offended anyone. I'm not sorry I've offended Ed, if anyone else.
Well, Paul Stewart said far worse during the podcast.
He did say far worse. But okay, right. Where this is going is that because you host this podcast, you rarely get the opportunity to comment on what's in the issue. You sat with us when we did the Paul, you know, we worked with Paul on the podcast, and he was a great guest. So tell us your impressions, Ed.
I thought it was very interesting, because I think a lot of sons of famous racing drivers find it very difficult to cope with that. But what was fascinating about Paul is he totally accepts that the fact having you know, his father, Jackie Stewart, as his father, kind of helped him in his career. The other thing I thought was fascinating was that he is someone who's very happy with where he got to. And a lot of drivers who, you know, got to where he got to, Formula 3000, you know, did a Formula 1 test, but never actually got into Formula 1. He's kind of okay with that. And he comes across as a sort of, he's totally accepted that. He had success with Stewart Grand Prix. But it's a very interesting life, because a lot of drivers are kind of, you know, are all about excuses and, you know, it didn't work out because of this, something like that. But he's not like that at all. And very grounded, considering, you know, he was picked up from school by Sean Connery.
He's a very balanced individual and a realist, and just, you know, thoroughly engaging and good bloke.
Yeah. Now we're going
to
just do.
Can I just jump in to big up Andrew Frankel a little bit as well, because we talked about his Bathurst feature there as well. I think he's very well known for doing his reviews, and he's brilliant at car reviews. And I just think this. This interview, this lunch with, just shows that he's
very good at eating lunch as well.
Well, but he can do a beautifully written and perceptive interview as well. And I thought it read brilliantly.
We are sort of sadly out of time, but I would just quite like to talk about Demolition Derby's Home Demolished, which is a sort of photo essay. So I think that's what we call it.
That's how we ended up with it, yeah.
Yeah. And
it's because he couldn't make photo documentary fit in the little bubble thing that he wanted.
All about the sodding design. Yeah.
As it should be.
This is obviously the fact that Wimbledon has closed down.
Yes.
But you didn't just go there and photograph the place when it was closed. You've actually been there and done it on numerous occasions to kind of get the sort of history of it as well.
From my point of view, this was before I joined the MAG full time. So it was a phone call conversation with Damon about this idea I had, and his words to me were, "Please don't offer this to anybody else." Now it's quite a bizarre for motorsport to feature, shall we say, banger racing and stock cars and everything else, but except for Simon, yeah. But through my freelance career, I've always been fascinated by people and the people behind the helmet rather than also just the car. And knowing that Wimbledon was going to be closing, I spent the last month of racing going every Sunday to see the people behind the whole event. So Banger Racing, stock cars, and the people at Speedworth that ran the events. And it was just fascinating to go from, say, a Formula One paddock to watching people repair cars under a spotlight in the absolute pouring rain.
With a hammer.
With a hammer and an angle grinder.
An angle grinder.
And it's just, for me, it was so amazing just to see the craggy faces, the passion on the faces throughout. It's a shame Wimbledon's gone because of what you could have seen there. And even seeing at the last event where the locals were coming from Wimbledon to something they've probably never seen before, to kind of give it one last hurrah kind of thing. And I hope that we've portrayed it in I know we were only there for a month, but to portray it in its all its glory, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, and again, I know you're just sitting a couple of seats away, but I was at several of the final few meetings. I mean, I raced at Wimbledon a few times in the 1980s in borrowed stock rods and bangers and various other things. Very different place, but I think you've captured the spirit of it wonderfully well. You know, I was there, as I say, and sad it's gone. No more short oval racing now inside the M25. There were once zillions of similar venues in London, all now gone.
Yeah, it's actually very, sort of quite eerie. Some of the photos. There's one of kind of inside. Is it the grandstands or inside? Where is it? There was still a half a bottle of whiskey left to kind of inside.
It was
as if there was kind of a bomb went off and everyone just ran out of the building and it was left.
We were invited back on the Monday after the final event, and it was literally, like you say, the apocalypse had happened, and it was just left for the demolition crew to come in, and yeah, the officers were still there from the day they locked the door and walked out. But it was very eerie the second day walking around. Very, you could almost hear the cars going around again, even though they weren't.
But you got access to the half of the stadium that had been closed
for the last 20 odd years.
Ten, whatever it was.
Yeah.
But, That was, yeah, that was quite special.
Was that because the asbestos?
The asbestos pigeon.
The things you go through for Motorsport magazine. There is another piece, another feature behind this called Secret Le Mans, and everyone in the office has contributed to this about the best things to do at Le Mans, the best ways to do it. And we've also spoken to different people outside the magazine as well. So if you are planning a trip to Le Mans, it is actually really worth a read. I've been there loads of times, but learned something. And it's brilliant if you do need to go to Le Mans, because I think too often you just end up booking something, not really thinking about what you're doing and how to go about it. So do give that a read. There's also, obviously, after this, columns from Gordon Cruikshank, Simon on my right, Doug Nye, as well as Private View, Data Trace, and Finish Line with Wyn Percy, and loads more that we haven't had time to discuss in this month's issue. We would be here for days if we were actually going to talk about every single detail. And then you wouldn't buy the magazine. So there wouldn't be any point in that. Nick, thank you so much. Damon, pleasure. Thank you. Lyndon,
thank you.
Joe, Simon, and thank you so much for Alan for recording all our dulcet tones. We'll be back next month with another Motorsport commentary behind the scenes, and we'll be talking about the July 2017 edition of Motorsport magazine. Thanks for listening. See you then.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.